May 24, 2005, I open the meeting of the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development. And today we are going to have an overview from the Oregon Lottery and also the from the some comment from the Governor's Office. And also, this is from the Department of Justice?
Yes.
Also the, from the Department of Justice. And we will begin with Mr. Dale Penn, the Director of Oregon Lottery. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I am the Director of the Oregon Lottery. I have a handout that I've provided, and I'd be happy to just give a brief overview of the lottery. I know you may have questions. I'd be happy to deal with those. I wanted to simply and quickly just go through this handout. It gives really some definitions for the lottery. Our mission statement on the second page is to operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good.
Okay. Director Penn, would you mind, is this the...
Yes,
the package?
Yes.
We have two packages, and I'm not sure the numbers know. Which
yes,
this one?
Okay. What I was going to go through and just is the overview presentation. And then you'll have a second packet, which is larger, which gives you our business plan and strategic plan and some balance sheets that are recent. And so the bigger packet is really material, if, source material, if you wish to go through it. But I was just going to go over the overview presentation here today and then try to respond to any questions that you would have. I think that it is very important at the lottery, and one of the high priorities that we have is the integrity and security of the games, and it is necessary that the people of Oregon trust the integrity of those games, and so we have that as a high priority. Consequently, if you turn to the next page, it shows the organizational structure, and the lottery is really controlled or policy set by a 5-member commission. These commissioners are appointed by the governor and reviewed and confirmed by the Senate. Two of the commissioners have some specific criteria for the background. One needs to be a law enforcement professional. One needs to be a certified public accountant. The other three are more general in their background. The director is also appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. I went through that process just recently in November, and I've been with the lottery for about the last 2 months. Then you see that we have assistant directors. One whole section is for security, as I mentioned, and we contract with the state police and have a state police lieutenant in charge of our security, does background, test games, and does investigations of potential fraud and that type of thing during operations of the lottery. And we have a marketing department because we have a sales organization. Retail operations is sales in the community and repairs of devices and games that we have, and then support services is basically our infrastructure to support our organization. The next slide talks about, a page talks about just the history of the lottery, and you'll see that in 1984, by voter initiative, two-thirds of the people voting approved the lottery, and it established in the Constitution the Lottery Commission and the Oregon State Lottery Fund to operate as a self-supporting revenue-raising agency of state government. And then you'll see that in that initial ballot measure, funds were dedicated to economic development, and over the years, by voter initiative, we've had some changes to that concerning education, parks and resources, and bonding authority for other state programs. If you turn to the next page, our job is to bring the dollars to the legislature. And you'll see that in the last biennium, the distribution by the Constitution and by the legislature on those dollars is described for you. A portion to the different programs that are there. I will say, just to note, that when it says $718.8 million were transferred, that was pursuant to a March forecast in 2004. And we have done better than that forecast, and this year we'll finish in this biennium transferring $770 million to the state. In the next page, you'll see that how have gains developed in the state of Oregon. And you'll see that we started out with scratchets and megabucks, and over the years, the commission has initiated and authorized other games. Down at the bottom of that list, you'll see line games with question marks. This Wednesday, the Lottery Commission will meet. They will have a public hearing at 10 o'clock, and the issue for them to decide at that time is, should the commission authorize line games as part of the products in the video lottery system? And you'll see that the legislature initiated two different types of games, one sports action and also the video lottery in 1992. The next page just shows some historical overview of the change in the lottery and some of the additions of games and how those games have increased revenues and sales, all the way up to the last column that shows we have started a new type of scratch-it ticket called Click and Play. And I think it is important that we continue to expand our types of games and, for instance, scratch-it tickets. They have a life of perhaps a year, and we have to keep moving them around and changing those games to keep them fresh. As we've shown legislators the different types of tickets and games that we have, scratch-it tickets is an interesting product because we've had it for so long, and generally we do have to replace those tickets every few months, except for two, and that is crossword puzzles and a bingo scratch-it ticket. They are timeless in their popularity, but other than that, we have to keep that product moving. People ask about our budget process, and so the next slide, page 9, gives a review of that process and is really the reason that I've given you the second handout, because a lot of the details are in that second lengthy handout. And basically, the lottery is a zero-based budget organization. Every year, we start with zero and we build from there. The Lottery Commission develops a strategic plan for the organization. Taking that general strategic plan, then the departments build a business plan, a marketing plan, a financial plan to run the organization, and specific projects that would help implement that strategic plan. We do have measurements of success for those different programs and projects. We will then construct a budget, provide it to the governor's office for review, and that comes back to the Lottery Commission itself for review, and then ultimately adoption of that budget for our year's plan. We're beginning that process anew in this month, and that will go forward, and the process usually completes in May for the next fiscal year, business year, beginning in July. Looking at the different types of games we have, and we divide them into two different general categories. Traditional games are the Scratch-Its, the Mega Bucks, really all of the games that we have had over the years. And you'll see that in dividing those up and the expenses, there are operating expenses for the general lottery operation. There are specific game expenses in traditional games. You can see printing costs and other costs for tickets, just an example of that. There is compensation to the dealers that or the retailers, I guess is maybe a better term, rather than dealing products, retailers who sell our traditional products. There are prizes that are paid out, which comprise the biggest portion of this. But out of this amount, 18.9% in 2004 was returned to the state as transfers to the state. That is basically around $60 million. Video lottery in the next graph or pie chart is a different type of game, and you'll see that the percentages are much different, and yet in describing this pie, it is much, much larger. The circumference of this circle is huge. And so when you talk about transfers of the state out of this game, you'll see 3.7% versus in the traditional game, it was about 19%. That 19% represented about $60 million. However, this 3.7% represents $292 million. And basically, in the last two calendar years, or business years, there has been transferred almost $600 million to the state from the video product alone. Prize payouts, 93%. People ask about that, and I guess the first time I analyzed that, I asked the question, well, why is it so high? And yet, when you look at the history, you'll see that in video lottery, it started at around 89%. When you look at standards in the industry, they're somewhere around, for line games, for instance, about 92%. Each game is a little bit different in its payout, but it establishes an amount that the public will accept and will play that game. Obviously, if people don't believe it's popular and don't enjoy the game, then they don't play it, your sales go down. But over time, this is the payout that has been consistently appropriate and has increased sales each year. And as these sales have increased, then the ability to transfer dollars to the state has increased. If you look at, well, I guess I don't have, well, I do have a slide, and I have to have you go all the way to page 16. Apologize, I probably should have put this right after the other page. But it gives you an example on page 16. It is a graph from the beginning of video lottery up until the present time, and it projects out continued economic growth in this game as projected by the economic advisors. But you see that's been almost steady growth in increase in play and consequently increase in transfer to the state of Oregon. Coming back to page 12, I mentioned that the lottery is operated as a self-supporting agency, and statutes say that no appropriation, loans, or other transfers of state funds shall be made to the lottery. And this is in the Constitution as well. What that means is the lottery has to pay its own way. It can't go out and borrow money. So we have to keep money in a reserve account to be able to fund our operations. And this is a contingency reserve account. This is established by the Lottery Commission, reviewed by the Commission. At the present time, it has $95 million in it. The reason I mention that is because it's important to understand what that $95 million is. Right away, $52 million of it is basically property, equipment that is owned by the lottery commissions as jobs, such as the machines, plus as such as equipment in actually performing the job. $43 million is cash. Of that, $20 million is necessary to have at all times to pay bills, to pay personnel, to keep the business of the lottery moving forward, which leaves us with an anticipated balance at the end of this business year of $23 million as a contingency in case there are any difficulties that we encounter that are unforeseen in that budget and business year. If those dollars are not necessary, they are brought over to the next year and would be utilized for capital requirements. Running this operation can be expensive. And the next page explains this. We presently have 10,000 video machines in the state of Oregon. Approximately 4,500 of those machines are 10 to 12 years old, are antiquated. 2,000 of the machines cannot support running games because of their age. In fact, they are not supported in any way, the software or the hardware. We cannot buy parts for these machines. So what we have to do is cannibalize other machines to be able to keep them running. We need to replace those machines. And there needs to be a replacement plan over time to keep these machines operating, to keep the games new, to keep sales moving forward. You can see they're expensive. We anticipate in the next year that we'll have to spend $56 million to replace these machines because they are not supported and in fact, they can't even be kept running. Then we have some additional costs. Our central computer system that runs all of the games, from tickets to video, processes somewhere in the course of a year approximately $9 billion. Now, not all of that money is new money. It is money that works within a system. For instance, in the video poker machine, the winnings that are not cashed out, but they are dollars that have to be processed in and processed out. So that network is extremely important. We're at a point where our network is getting old. We're in the process of doing an RFP to replace that network and to upgrade it. But you can see that we have some costs that we need to pay just in the next year to keep that network going as we do an RFP. That process of RFP and actual construction and implementation is at earliest a three-year enterprise. So we have routers and we have game chips and other processes and equipment that need to be plugged into that network to keep it operating. The lottery, I have learned, has many audits. And so on page 14, we've tried to update you on the last round of audits. We've just finished a Secretary of State's audit on our operations. We've had no material findings in the last 2 years. We're just in the process of finishing a security review. We have that every 2 years. And we're happy to say that Oregon's lottery meets or exceeds best practices in the United States lotteries throughout the nation. We have a component of internal auditors constantly reviewing our process and procedures, and there is an audit committee of the commission staffed by commissioners that reviews our audit activities and the reports of our auditing department. I want to move to page 15, and then I'll just about be done here and be happy to answer any questions you might have. The forecast for the next biennium. There has been some confusion about this, and so I've tried to break this down to explain it a little bit here. The governor's recommended budget identifies $933 million in transfers from the lottery for that biennium. $120 million of that amount is targeted for land gains if the Lottery Commission approves land gains at its Wednesday meeting this week. So we need to subtract 120 from the 933 to look at what I will term base operations or current service levels of the lottery. That means $813 million in transfers in the next biennium. Some legislators have looked at that figure and said that seems like a huge jump from where we are now. But remember, the figure that is being used is a past projection that is outdated. And it was that $713 million figure that was actually on one of my early charts. And I mentioned to you that that was a projection figure from the past. It is not an accurate figure. And in fact, this biennium, we will transfer $770 million to the state budget. So really the growth that is there for this next biennium in base operations, I'm not talking about land games, the growth is from $770 million to $813 million. And in fact, when you look at that, that is a 5.4% increase each year over that period of time, which is the projection by economic advisors as they have projected for you income coming in from income tax. They also project lottery dollars. So we believe that is a eminently appropriate figure and doable and based upon past history. The $120 million figure for line games. Again, I've been asked lots of questions about this, and I don't want to get the cart before the horse here because the Lottery Commission still needs to make that decision this Wednesday. But in looking at that figure, we have tried to look at other jurisdictions and see what has line games done in those jurisdictions. We do not have an exact duplicate that we can look to. We can't go to a particular state or a province in Canada and say, just the addition of line games, what has that accomplished? We can look in those jurisdictions and we can see a range of from $46 million to $170 million that appears to be because of line games. There is no question but that line games will increase sales. That has happened uniformly everywhere worldwide. Oregon is unique in that we have been a video poker operation only. Every other jurisdiction has had line games besides poker. And what they have seen is very quickly that mix of games becomes 90% line games and about 10% poker. If you go into any casino, you will see about a 90% line game distribution of machines and a small number of poker. So there's no question that this is a popular game. We have done some surveys of our players and general public. Every 6 months we do surveys of individuals just to see how the lottery is doing, what games might we shift to help our sales. And again, line games comes up as a product that the public wants. And in fact, one interesting question that we ask is, what is your opinion of the lottery if we offer line games? Surprisingly, our favorable rating goes up 2 points from 87% to 89% if, in fact, we were to offer line games. So we have tried to look at a figure that is a middle-of-the-road projection, and that's what we believe that $120 million represents. It would require us to increase sales just because of line games by 10 or 11% to capture $120 million to transfer to the state of Oregon. We believe that is attainable and is appropriate. The last thing I'll say there, looking at West Virginia, that is a state that we can look at. They have casinos, so we can't just model ourselves after West Virginia. But the reason it is interesting is they do have a retailer network of machines very similar to ours. And so if we isolate that retailer network, just like our retailer network, and we look at what is the amount of income available in West Virginia, challenged state in employment ways and in population compared to Oregon. But if you compare their revenue and the amount that they spend on their video retailer network, compare that to the amount of revenue available in Oregon and the amount spent on our retailer network, you'll see a growth potential of 17%. Which seems to be at a maximum amount that we could expect if the West Virginia experience was duplicated in Oregon. We don't think it's appropriate to forecast 17%, but we think that's a good outside limit and that we have an opportunity to reach that. But we think the 10 to 11% forecast, $120 million, is appropriate and doable. The last thing I'll say is the last slide on page 17. This is our 20th anniversary as the Oregon Lottery. And in that 20 years, $4 billion has been transferred to the state of Oregon to help economic development, to support public schools, to maintain our state parks, to rebuild watersheds, and to fund gambling treatment services. We believe this has been a wonderful exercise for Oregon and has benefited the community. It is a pleasure for me personally to work in the lottery and to see the people who are committed to the job that they have and to understand that they see their goal as to bring resources to the state of Oregon, and in fact the lottery really does do good things. So with that, I'll be happy to answer questions that you might have for me.
Any questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the 87% favorable rating. Do you have some demographic figures that you could share with us about that polling?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Riley. We showed some figures to the House Revenue Committee. I was looking to see if I had those. Just a moment. Yes, we have done a review of, and we update this every 6 months to see who is the player of lottery products in Oregon. And basically what you find is that your average Oregonian utilizes and plays lottery products. We can give you specific examples. We've tried to compare our player profile against the American Community Survey profile, which is done by the United States Census Bureau. The last information we have from that profile is 2002. But we've compared our most recent profile with that. And so that you see that the male population in Oregon is 50%. 47% of male population utilize and play lottery products. 50% of the population is female in Oregon. 53% of our player base is female. A little bit more female than male. But as far as age categories, education level, ethnicity, and other areas, we see that they're almost exactly the same. When we look at education level, some college and technical college training, we actually have about 35% of our players fit that category, whereas they make up 28% of the population. That's one place where there's a little bit difference. Income level is another area that we've been asked about, and we actually have a smaller percentage of people who make less than $15,000 a year. About 11% of our base plays lottery products, whereas that comprises about 17% of the Oregon population. Our largest amount of players is in the $15,000 to $50,000 range of annual income, and that makes up about 42% of the population, whereas that's about 45% of our lottery player base. But in looking across all different categories, what you'll find is that we see very little difference compared between the lottery player profile in all of these different categories.
Follow-up, please.
We'll follow-up.
Director Payne, that's very interesting, but what I was really asking is not the player profile, but the profile of the polling that you've done, if you've done some, to find out the favorability that the Oregonians have for the lottery.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I didn't bring that material with me. However, just off the top of my head, I will say that as we looked at lottery players, and there were differences between people that play video poker in bars, which are poker machines. Video machines must be in an establishment that has an OLCC license by law. About 50% of those players said they would like to try line games. And then we also found a favorable percentage of people who do not go and play this game now, about 28% of the population saying we would like the opportunity to try that. So we believe that we can bring in this area of line games a certain population of new players to this game besides just the popularity of the game itself. So we do believe that the ability to increase sales is certainly there.
If you could give us some data to the committee members, I would appreciate it about the demographics of your polling.
Okay, yes.
And particularly, you know, who are players and who aren't players and what their opinions were.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Penn, for your testimony. As the state is looking to expand gambling, if you will, in the state, I'd ask you, if you would, to define problem gambling. Give us a little more detail on that, and then tell us the current state. What are the trends? Where are we right now? Which way is it going?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bruin, problem gambling is a situation that we will continue to analyze and look at. The legislature passed a statute 4 or 5 years ago that said that 1% of the proceeds should be dedicated to fund problem gambling treatment. You will receive a letter from the commission asking all the legislature and the governor to continue to protect and appropriate that 1%. The Department of Human Resources actually runs the treatment programs. We don't participate in running them. We simply provide those funds. But they receive an appropriation from the legislature. They are feeling like they are at the point where they need the full 1% appropriated. they have not necessarily seen an increase in people seeking treatment, but the treatment is available there. They do believe any time that you have an expansion, by necessity, there will be some expansion in problem gambling. As a lottery, although they don't see that line games as a product is any more addictive than any other gambling product, but just the fact that you'll bring more people into gambling, you'd expect to see a same percentage of new people now having difficulty. The lottery has looked at research and has funded some programs. You may see from time to time some programs that we have both on television and in newspaper ads. The most recent one was a man playing a pinball game, and it talked about when does a game no longer be a game and become a problem. And we use that to post the 1-800 number for people who are having problems with games and gambling, and to get that message out. We have decided that our next round of those particular types of outreach would feature a female, because we wondered that there was at least a phenomena that less women were calling in to DHR for treatment services. And so we thought maybe our approach should focus on a female in a similar kind of situation. So that's going to be our next approach in the next few months. But I will finish up with, Oregon has an outstanding record when you compare us to other states or provinces in Canada of keeping in mind problem gambling, and I think the legislative assignment of problem gambling resources has been a tremendous step forward. We do keep it in mind when we develop new games, when we put games in the market, and as we said, we're constantly looking at research in that area. So as we look at line games, that will be something that we'll have testimony on Wednesday about for the commission, and that will be part of their decision-making process for line games.
Okay, that's fine. Representative DeLume.
Yes, Chairman, I'd like to know, how does Oregon compare with other states in scope of gambling, number of games, revenue raised, dollars spent per capita, those sort of things? If you were to line up 50 states, where would we fall as a gambling state?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Dowen, it is difficult to compare. I do believe that Oregon's lottery has been very successful. As you can see, the percentages and the amounts of money returned to the state has increased year to year. Other states, typically, we are the only jurisdiction that has video lottery that doesn't have a casino. And so every other state that has video has casinos. And so it's very difficult to compare that because a casino operation changes the whole outlook. Other states have racetracks with casinos. And we're a little bit different in that we've had our traditional product, scratch-it tickets and megabucks and Powerball and that type of thing, and then put this video network out with poker only. Again, we're the only jurisdiction that does poker only. Every other place in the world that has video has line games. And so all we can really judge against is that we do produce a tremendous amount of money. At the end of this biennium, we'll be approaching $1 billion of transfers every biennium. You saw in the first 20 years of operation, we transferred $4 billion over that 20 years. The transfer rate for scratch-it tickets and the original games was fairly small. And I imagine those people who started the lottery 20 years ago would never imagine that there would be a $1 billion transfer every 2 years. But So we can look at numbers, but it is very difficult to compare them. We can certainly judge our history and see that our increase in transfers to the state has literally been at an angle about 45%.
I guess I'm looking at follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please hold on at this time. We will catch up later. Since Marilyn has to leave around 9:30, I'd like to come join the director. And so, thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Chair Lim, Vice Chair Bruin, and Vice Chair Merkley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marty Lynn Sapoff. I'm here in my context as General Counsel to the Governor, and I believe you had specifically asked me to talk for just a moment about the Governor's views with respect to lottery, but I think specifically the move to line games. And then to the extent you have any questions regarding legal authority, I can answer a few of those, and then I'll probably call my colleague up, who is the attorney for lottery from Department of Justice.
Also, if possible, I'd like to hear what's going on in the Cascade Lock area, any movement in it, if you could some comment on it.
Why don't I talk a little bit about the gaming situation in lottery,
yeah,
and then I'll try to end with that.
Yes, please. Thank you.
First of all, I didn't prepare testimony. I think that all of you are very familiar with the governor's statements, but I thought I would just give a moment to reiterate the things that the governor has recently, in the last month or two, stated with respect to his budget and the direction to move to line games that he's given to the commission or asked the commission to consider. First, I know that you're all aware that this was the hardest decision that he had to make with respect to issuing his budget. The decision to move to line games was clearly not a first choice, not even a second choice, a choice that he felt had to be made in the context of the very clear message from the voters that they are not, they do not want us to consider new taxes. In that context, and in the context of trying to do what he could to save vital services that the state provides, he made the decision to request the commission to consider moving to line games. The move to line games, with the projection of $120 million for the 05-07 biennium that Director Penn has discussed recently, will basically fund $329 state troopers, and it's intended to halt the forced reductions of the state troopers. I know that most of you are aware that over the last two decades that state troopers have gone from somewhere around 640 down to 329. In that context, the governor's concerns, and I know that you know he has concerns about gaming in Oregon, but the governor's concerns about public safety far outweighed his concerns about this, what I would say is a minimal expansion to line games in Oregon. The other context I think I was asked to address, given that I'm here in my role as legal counsel to the governor, had to do with legal authority. I'm going to just begin by making a general sweeping statement that attorneys are well known for, and that is that there's really no serious question in my mind, in the governor's mind, and I believe in the Department of Justice's mind, that we have legal authority to ask the commission to move to line games. Believe it or not, with that, that was short and sweet, and I'd be willing to answer your questions if you'd like me to do so at this time.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marty Lynn, is this a one-time event, or will this 15% of the lottery that the governor has ordered for state police funding be a permanent fund number, just like education and economic development?
The amount that's being asked to be dedicated to the state troopers, I believe the governor would like that to be ongoing, but clearly that's a legislative question as to whether or not it would be dedicated to state troopers going forward is actually a question that the legislature is dealing with this session, whether or not they would agree with that.
And follow-up, is the governor's office preparing a bill for that permanency of this degree of funding through the lottery for OSP?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, members of the committee, definitely that will be included in the governor's budget and the appropriate appropriations bills that would designate that amount.
And last follow-up, Mr. Chair. And as far as Cascade Locks is concerned, does the governor anticipate finding himself in the court system for numerous years since, you know, others will, other tribes will feel that they should have that same option?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, and members of the committee, maybe I should begin by making a quick general statement about Indian gaming, and you've raised the question of Cascade Locks. First and foremost, I want to point out that an Indian casino in Cascade Locks is not, as I use the term, a done deal. There's been no formal agreement at this time. Most of you are aware that last April, I think I've got the date right, the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs sent a letter to our office requesting formal negotiations to relocate their the Caneta Resort Casino, relocate the Caneta Resort to a site in Hood River. They were aware at the time they sent the letter that the governor was opposed to that relocation to that site. They were also aware, I make another general statement, I think that most Oregonians would have been opposed to the relocation of the reservation site in Hood River. In the alternative in that letter, which is, by the way, a public document, I'm happy to provide it for the committee. I didn't realize I'd be talking about this today. I would have brought it with me. In the alternative in that letter, they suggested to the governor that they would be willing to discuss a relocation to the Cascade Locks area in exchange for not locating to Hood River. The Hood River site is reservation land. Under federal law, we have a good faith obligation required by that law to negotiate with the tribes. On discussions, I've called them more discussions in the last year, have been an intent and a goal to protect the area and Hood River. And in that context, we've discussed what it would mean for us to allow them to move to Cascade Locks, which would be off-reservation. I believe, Chair Lynn, you asked for a status report. The best status report I can give you is that, what I said before, it's not a done deal. Not a done deal until we all agree. There are numerous issues, mostly having to do with how we would like to protect the Hood River Reservation area. There are other issues that are on the table, always issues with the tribes in terms of our ability to deal with regulatory issues. The tribes are sovereign nations. In a reservation context versus an off-reservation context, that raises lots of questions in our minds about what does that mean to regulate a sovereign entity off-reservation. Those discussions have taken a significant amount of time. The governor's goal in any discussion with Indian tribes on gaming is to ensure the integrity of the games, to ensure the protection of Oregonians in terms of fraud, other issues of that nature.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Merkley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. One of the legal issues that has been raised is, given that the Constitution defines where lottery funds can be spent, and given that highway troopers are not on that list, what are the legal underpinnings to this proposal?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Merkley, members of the committee, let me begin by basically stating that there is no real definition of economic development in the statutes. Certainly, the legislature has the authority to, in fact, leave it open-ended the way it is now, for the most part. The legislature has the authority, of course, to define it in broader terms or to restrict that definition. At this time, the legal analysis that we've applied basically has looked at what would the nature of funding state troopers facilitate in terms of economic development. And I believe that I can safely say that even in my brief sojourn in the private sphere at times, that one thing the business is very clear about when they locate to a state, when they think about expanding in a state, and that is the stability of the legal structure and the public safety system. And I believe that I can represent the governor in saying that it is a consistent concern to all businesses and industry and to Oregonians as to whether or not their businesses, their homes, their schools are safe. I believe that the economic development component here goes to the need to make our economy consistent, reliable, and to make our infrastructure part of that consistency. So that's the link. I would also say that, as you all know, the governor has repeatedly said that to the extent the legislature does not agree with his view on the dedication to state troopers as being part of an economic development assistance or move support, that to the extent we could find other money for state troopers, he would be fine if that money then was redirected to education.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative DeLoon.
Yes, Chairman. I would like to know, as the confines of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation fall completely within House District 59, and because the sovereign nation of the Warm Springs are looking for economic development to take care of children, poverty, and jobs. Is there some sort of a timeline that the governor has established for making this decision? Will we know next month, next spring, next year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahl, members of the committee, given that I'm the governor's negotiation person on this deal, I would tell you that the timeline is as fast as I can get it done, and I'm certainly hoping that it doesn't interfere with session any more than it needs to. I don't have a timeline for you. He certainly would like to have a decision, and by that I mean a decision whether we're going to do this deal or whether a yes decision or a no decision on it. And I would say in the next month, I'm hoping to at least be able to have him know enough of the information that he can come to that decision. I can't guarantee that.
Follow up. Then without tipping your negotiating hand, is it the intention of the Warm Springs, at least in negotiations, if the Cascade Lock site is not developable, will they move to the Hood River site, and can we anticipate a casino in Hood River?
Ms. Chair Lim, Representative Dahlen, I can only tell you what the Warm Springs tell me, and what they essentially put in the letter that they gave us last April, and that is that they fully intend to move to Hood River.
I thought one more follow-up. Have they given you a timeline?
Chair Lim, Representative Dahlen, have they given me a timeline of when they will move?
Is their patience exhaustible?
Chair Lim, Representative Dahl, I think in a negotiation I would say the other side's patience is always exhaustible. I think at this time that if we were not able to come to some decision maybe in the next 6 months, that I think we would all agree we would call it quits. We've been working on this for far too long.
And then build at Hood River.
I think that's exactly what they would at least begin. They have plans already going in that direction. I don't know how far along those plans are, so I couldn't say would they be ready to move at the end of this year. Probably not. But they had started plans in that direction, so I'm assuming that they would pick those plans up, or they could be operating them simultaneously while we're doing other. I would say that a significant portion of the negotiation isn't about the necessity of a site. It's about the regulatory matters I mentioned, and to the extent those issues we've negotiated would apply to any restated compact that we engaged in. There are a number of regulatory issues that we constantly have ongoing discussions with them on, and all of that part of our negotiations for the last year are not, they're not gone by the wayside.
One follow-up. Then is the issue of sites pretty much settled? The governor agrees that Cascade Locks is the appropriate site, or has that been settled?
Chair Lim, Representative Dahlen, I think that's not what I said. What I indicated is that to the extent we were not able to agree on a site in Cascade Locks or a site in Hood River, all right, the negotiations, a good portion of our negotiations were about restating their compact. Their compact hasn't been, it's been amended over the last 10 years, but not restated as a complete compact. We would still do that in all of the negotiations we've had regarding regulations and relationships between the state and the tribe and relationships with the Oregon State Police Gaming Division. All of those would go into a restated compact, regardless of the site.
We can't look for something within a month.
You can look for me saying what the status is in another month.
Thank you very much.
Marty Lynn, I know your time is pretty much up, but we will invite you sometime again. But I have one question that the our state continually expanding this the gambling and associated with the social cost. I'm wondering, governor's office ever that they studied on the issue of social cost. We might be gaining $700 million up to $1 billion in biennium, but the social cost associated with it might be even greater. And I'm wondering, governor, has ever studied on this issue? I know this is not a simple answer, but we got to find out some answer on this issue.
Chairman, members of the committee, to answer your question, yes, we continuously look at the social cost. If you're referring specifically to lottery and gaming, I know that Director Penn mentioned the gambling addiction program through DHS. One thing that he didn't mention that I wanted to mention, because I'm sure some of you have met the governor's advisor for Health and Human Services, Aaron Kelly Seal. Aaron and I work very closely together, I on the, of course, the gaming side, and she on the Health and Human Services side. And just recently, she and I were talking about the correlation between success and recovery rate and the 1% dedicated to gambling addiction. Don't know how many of you realize, but Oregon has probably the finest gambling addiction program in the nation, and our recovery rate far out exceeds anybody else's. We have an 80% recovery rate. For just a little bit more money, we get amazing results. So I would say, yes, we do. There are other social costs, I know that, Chairman, that you're concerned about. Aaron and I have, no matter, whenever I do any gaming meetings or talk with people on gaming, she and I correlate and we talk about, well, what will this tell us? What can we do on the social cost side of this to address that issue? I think she would probably be a better person to get you data and statistics about that if you need any follow-up on that.
Okay. I'm not just talking about the 1% dedicated for the treatment of the gambling people, but what I'm talking about, the bigger picture, such as so many people, and they lost their jobs, and they are not functioning well. They sometimes that their families that they got a lot of problems associated with it. I think this problem could be bigger than drinking itself. This is a mental disease, and then I think we need to find out the answer. Just 1% dedicated, that this will help. This might be helping just a little bit, scratch the surface, but there's a real bigger picture. The director mentioned that this is a 20th anniversary since the inception of this gaming, and then we didn't have any clear answer. What that has been cost of our state in terms of jobs, in terms of a mental disease, and associated with it. I think we need to find out that answer. I'm wondering, do we have any study on that? We could have the copy of it.
Chairman, members of the committee, I don't know of an exact study. I know we look at the issue, so there very well could be. I can follow up in our office to see if there is any particular report or study done, and I think Director Penn could do the same.
Okay, and Vice Chair Mockley would like to have a question on the same subject.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on your point about the social costs, because I think it's very appropriate to raise it, and certainly it was absent from the materials that were being presented to the committee. 2 years ago, a bipartisan group of legislators met with the Lottery Commission and met with the governor to talk about the social costs, to go over a series of studies that showed that for every dollar raised for the state,
approximately $2 to $3 of social cost resulted. And this is because however much you can cure someone of gambling addiction, the point before you're cured may be the devastation of the family, with huge impact upon kind of a wake of social damage that proceeds from that. And so certainly and this comes in the form of child abuse, spousal abuse, divorce, loss of income, just a huge number of things. I certainly will be encouraging the commission to look again at those studies that show $2 to $3 of social damage for each dollar of revenue, and taking that into account when they meet on Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. It seems you have to go around 9:30. I'm going to let you go this time. We will invite you back sometime in the near future to discuss many other issues involved with it. And especially, I'd like to have some answer on the social cost in the future, plus some other matters we have in mind. So thank you very much for your coming, and appreciate it. Thank you.
Berlin, members of the committee, seeing as I was here last Monday, are you telling me this is going to be an every Monday morning? Who brings the donuts next week?
All right.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it being here, and feel free to ask me again.
Thank you. Okay. Dale, do we have any additional questions?
Yes.
I was asking for a per capita comparison on dollars spent on gambling, and perhaps if revenue raised by gambling could be divided by state population, I could get some notion of how Oregon stacks up in money spent per capita. So we know whether we're a big gambling state, a small gambling state. I'd like some notion of where we sit on that continuum.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dallin, we can try to come up with that. The difficulty is that you really are talking different measures. That's why when we were trying to look at line games, we tried to isolate. Let's just look at West Virginia with a retailer network and Oregon with a retailer network. Because when you bring into the casino operations, it so changes the outlook and just the operation itself. It's very difficult to compare those. But I can, in general, look at that and try to give you some information.
I guess maybe the focus would change. You could, I'm trying to determine how reliant we have become on gambling compared to other states, a dollar figure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penn, thank you very much for being here. Recently, we talked on the telephone about this great idea of dividing the lottery into million-dollar awards to expand, really, economic recovery in this state, and I ask you if we could consider million-dollar awards, and would you relate to the committee how you responded to me?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think you spoke with a person in the office, but I was told about the conversation, and I don't know exactly what was said to you, but I will report to you what a staff person told me was one of the difficulties, and at least in the 2 or 3 months that I've been with the lottery, the observation that I've made about megabucks. During the time that I was there, the largest megabucks jackpot in history rolled to the point and was awarded a few weeks after I took the position of director. And what we see is that jackpots drive sales of megabucks. And one of the problems that we have is with $1 million, once a jackpot is won, the megabucks goes down to $1 million. And our sales go just like this.
and sales increase as the jackpot increases. Now, I'll use my one little observation, a personal observation about Megabucks. Prior, I cannot play any Oregon Lottery games, obviously, now. Before I became director, however, I did play Megabucks from time to time, but I never bought a ticket unless the jackpot was at least $6 million. That's kind of stupid, but that was the way I look at it. I don't know how many people I've talked to, they tell me the same thing. And clearly, sales figures are driven by that jackpot. So one of the problems I think we would have in just saying we're going to have a $1 million jackpot and it will not increase is I believe that clearly our sales would fall dramatically. But that's the practical problem. I understand the motivation to say let's spread the wealth around and that would perhaps help the state in doing so. The issue would be trying to look at are we having less sales and then can we support a $1 million jackpot based upon the amount of sales that we have. Those would be the practical issues.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I apologize for saying you when I was talking about your group, your division. Okay. Could I ask you two questions? One, when we have been told what our disbursement is to be, why did we spend more in both areas of economic development and education than what we're told to spend the 15%. I noticed according to your budget figures here you did, and I'm just curious because that was turned out to be 2%. And I wonder if you could give us the number of seniors who gamble and contribute money, as I hear across the United States, especially women above 50 are the greatest contributors to our economy. And no, I'm not putting you guys down if you're over 50. But I'm just curious, and you know, I think it's very important that since they are the greatest contributors, that a substantial percentage of the lottery funds go to senior and disabled services, since they're the ones funding the projects.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. My chart there about how these dollars were spent was just a general overview, and we do not make any decisions about how you would utilize those dollars, and so I'm not trying to put a value judgment or anything else. It's just we brought forward this amount of money, and what we were told from the Revenue Committee was that's the way it was divided. So don't rely upon that. You'll have more direct evidence that's more accurate. I'm just trying to give you a big picture of percentages.
Can I correct what I said? According to the chart on page 6, Parks and Recreation got 16%, should have gotten 15. Education Stability Fund got 19. It should have gotten 18. So what are the demographics regarding seniors and those over 50, please, who gamble?
Mr. Sharon Upson Nelson, just looking at this study that I mentioned to you earlier, I didn't really talk much about age. And so I'll look here and note that Oregon, again, we do have a slight increase or a higher percentage of women playing lottery than is than makes up Oregon. It's 53% to 50%. Okay, so there's slight increase in women. Looking at the ages 45 to 54, Oregon population is 21%. 45 to 54, and we have 22% of our player base in those years. Then it goes down. 55 to 64, 14% of the population is that age. Our player base is 13%.
But do we know the volume of gambling in, if I could, sorry, Mr. Chair, in those areas of the $770 million? what percentage of that is. Mm-hmm. It may only be 14%, but what's the percentage of contribution?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Nelson. This is based upon surveys of individuals, and it gives us a picture of them, but we don't have individual information to be able to say that this income level is participating 60% or 50%, so I can't answer that precise question for you.
Can I just ask, Mr. Chair, is it possible that we could get that information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I will go back and see if we have anything that can help answer that question.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Penn, a belated welcome to your new job. I'm sure it's going to be a challenging one, but I hope it's a fulfilling one for you. I'd like to make just a brief comment, and then I have two questions to ask. First, I'd like to back the statement from our chair with a sincere request for a study of the social costs of what we're doing with gambling in the state of Oregon. It's my personal belief we've lost our moral compass when we're depending on gambling to fund the education of our children rather than paying for the education of our children. The lottery, as I understand it, was intended to be a boost to our budget, not a foundation for our budget, and I'm very uncomfortable with the direction that we're heading in. That being said, in the materials you presented, you talk about with the video poker, I believe it is, a 93%, I think it's on page 11, 93.82% prize payout with the video lottery. Has there been a study done that would show what would happen to sales and also revenue at 92%?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Buckley. As I tried to discuss, it is a very complicated issue. Generally, what you have to do is the customer base is going to tell you the popularity of the game. And so what has happened over the years, historically, 14 years ago or so, when video lottery began, games were programmed at around 89%. Then there were new games that were brought in that were programmed at different levels, and immediately the higher programmed games became the number one sellers across the board. And so really for the last 10 years there has been one particular game that has been the game on every type of machine, and it changes a little bit by the manufacturer, but it can be as high as a 94% game and a 92%. It ends up in this 93%. But and as we've tried to shift and put other games in, that game is still the number one, and that's the one people play, and we can't really tamper with it. As new games come in, though, that is where you have an opportunity to look at and be very careful about how do you program the game and what is the standard, what do other jurisdictions use, and what's appropriate so that players will say, yeah, this is consistent with what I'm used to over in this other location and that type of thing. And so as we begin looking at line games, if we move towards that after Wednesday, I've been told that the industry standard is 92%, and that's what we would look at for line games.
Okay. One more question, if you would. Speaking of standards, the commission paid to retailers for the lottery games, if we were to lower that to 20%, according to the Oregon Business Association, we could bring in $68 million more to our schools. And I'm wondering if you will have a recommendation to the commission to lower the commission rate, and please know that I personally would strongly encourage you to do so.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buckley, yes, I have mentioned I believe there's a proposal out there to adopt 15%, and this organization proposed 20%. It is something that, yeah, we would carefully look at, and I think any recommendation I would make, if the commission authorizes line games, is something lower than there is now. I think it's also very important to keep in mind that network is producing $600 million per biennium and projected to produce $650 million next biennium. And so that we want to make sure that we don't endanger that base funding, but that clearly it appears that there could be some extra revenue available by changing rates, and that would be my recommendation. What the number would be, I'm struggling with, but we'll see after Wednesday. Thank you.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Line games are so called because you line up a series of symbols on a line, and obviously it's much less complicated undertaking than thinking about the odds of poker and so forth. But one of the things that has become embedded in electronic line games as opposed to the old mechanical games is manipulation of symbols that are just off the line. That is sometimes referred to as near miss manipulation, so that you may not win, but you see that three sevens are lined up just above or just below. And when I say manipulation, what I'm saying is that they're represented in disproportionate statistical presence from what they would be if it was a mechanical game. And so this is designed to make sure the player keeps playing, believes that they almost won, and so forth. Is this technology, which is combined with other technology, including the visual flashing of the screen, the sounds that are embedded, is designed to keep people playing, if you will? It's been described as the factors that contribute to the addiction rate and why video poker and line games are more addictive than other forms of gambling. Certainly the player assumes that the reel electronically presented replicates a mechanical reel, just as they assume in poker that the cards are being dealt fairly. Is this sort of near-miss manipulation appropriate for the games that you're going to offer, and will the games you're going to offer have that feature?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, you're correct. The games do have all types of, all games have teasers and all types of ways to manipulate them. And that is something that I mentioned earlier. We're always analyzing in new games that the impact and problem gambling. Certainly we're aware of those issues. As we've brought out other products, we've always tried to stay more of the middle of the road and stay away from inflammatory parts of the game that can greatly increase problem gambling, and so that's something that we would have in the forefront and would be an issue for us to deal with. I can't tell you precisely at this point, you know, what our game mix would be or what would be the particular games, but I do know that's an issue that we've identified and that we would analyze, and that we would keep in mind our commitment to be responsible and to not be irresponsible in increasing problem gambling. So we'll certainly take it into account, and as we have in the past.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. I have a couple of questions. Could you tell me what was the total wager in biennium? We are talking about the $700+ million, but what was the total amount people waged on it? Any idea?
Mr. Chair, that's a difficult question to answer, only because with video lottery,
especially
which
video,
is done by a machine, there is a churn factor. I can tell you that the total amount, including the churn factor, is $9 billion. However, a lot of that is people putting money in, generating credits, and in effect receiving credits that count as dollars, but not cashing them out, and ultimately either leaving their dollars there or cashing out less amount. So, I don't know that I can totally answer that question for you. I can try to go back and get you a figure, but I know when you talk about dollars in and dollars out and churn factor, it's $9 billion.
Okay. Are you talking about this biennium?
Yes.
Okay.
This was the last biennium.
last biennium.
Yes.
Okay, and if you could get some additional information, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly.
And according to the Constitution, the lottery department could use up to 16% of the net proceeds. I'd like to find out what is the current percentage you use, and what has been in the past 10 years, the percentage of administration cost is increased or decreased as the lottery amount net proceeds going up.
Mr. Chair, our goal was to stay under 4%, and over the last 10 years, that's fluctuated a little bit. 2 years ago, there was an immense effort made to greatly reduce administrative costs. I don't think that it ever went above 4%, but I think it's gotten down to like 2.6, and we're under 3, and we try to stay at under 3.
That doesn't include the dealer account compensation. You're talking about the administration.
No, Mr. Chair, no. That's the administrative costs of the funding of the lottery as an organization, our overhead, personnel costs, all of those types of things. Now, compensation to retailers would be another expense item, but we break that out separately.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that why at the time of creating this lottery constitution limited up to 16% seems like too high at this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, back when the lottery was started, the products that were available, primarily scratch-it tickets and Megabucks, which were the two first programs, the administrative costs of those games are very high. And if you look at one particular scratch-it ticket, you are close to 16% because of all the costs involved in printing and manipulating and selling and storing and all that goes into it. That is a very expensive game percentage-wise to work with. Video lottery has less expenses and has a much bigger base, and so that brings that percentage down greatly. But I think at the time the lottery was developed, 16% was a close figure and took a lot of hard work to stay within those guidelines. Over the years, that's changed. That's why we don't even try to consider 16% as a figure for us. As I said, our goals are to stay under 4%.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Penn, when we started the lottery, I was concerned because all of our printing was being done out of the state, and I'm always looking at that. Could you tell me who gets our money now? I hope it's all in state.
Mm. Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, I wish I could say that for tickets. Let's talk about tickets. And certainly we do all of our printing of forms and everything else the lottery does, letterheads and everything. We do that in state and that type of thing. But tickets themselves are a very unique item. And they have to be done in a very secure environment. They are like money. And so the number of organizations that print tickets is very small. Our primary vendor is located in Texas, and it is a company that prints money.
Tear my heart out now.
Yeah. And it is a very secure organization. They used to print all types of postage stamps, money, all types of things like that. And they evolved in their United States operation to lottery tickets.
Could you please tell us, Mr. Penn, who... how much that is, how much money is spent in printing, and don't we have that capability to do that? Wouldn't that be great economic development?
Well, Ms. Sharon Epson Nelson, I agree with that. However, for it to be a cost-effective operation, I really have to look at that a little bit, because I know that there are really only about
six or eight printers that we can work with as lottery for these tickets. I said one was in Texas. We just did a background investigation and a bid for contracts, and we have a Canadian organization that does a lot of printing for the Canadian lotteries, and one other United States manufacturer, but I'm not aware of one in the state of Oregon. That isn't to say that someone in venture capital couldn't do it, but it would be a huge investment of resource, and you'd have to be able to get contracts from throughout the United States and the world to really be competitive. I think that's a problem.
And what do we spend on that? What do we give to Texas and others?
I'd have to get the exact amount for printing. I'd be happy to return that.
Right. Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to call the Sarah. Do I pronounce it? Kastner. Okay, thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Certainly.
Could you give us your name and your title before you speak?
Certainly. Yeah. Good morning, Chair Lim, representative or members of the committee. My name is Sarah Kastner, and I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice. And currently, I am assigned as lottery's legal counsel.
All right. Thank you.
It's my understanding that I was asked to be present today because you had some questions about the constitutional authority of the Oregon Lottery offering line games in light of the prohibition in the Constitution of establishing casinos. And so I'm here prepared to basically tell you that based on our office's review of the Constitution and based on ORS 461-215, ORS 461-217, and the decision by the Oregon Supreme Court in Ecumenical Ministries versus the Oregon State Lottery, we have concluded that that basically the type of game that is offered is not what constitutes a casino. So the test is not what is the nature of the video game that's being offered. The test of whether or not an establishment is a casino is the extent of the gambling activity in that establishment. And as the Oregon Supreme Court has stated, basically the test is an establishment is a casino if its dominant use or its dominant purpose is for gambling. But it's not based on the nature of the games that are being played there. It's based on, like, the income or the space that's being used for gambling. Those are the things that lottery looks at in deciding whether or not the dominant use or dominant purpose of that retailer is gambling or whether it's permissible under the Constitution.
Yes. Could you expand a little bit that the definition of the dominant the use or dominant purpose?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you what lottery's definition of dominant use, dominant purpose. Unfortunately, the Oregon Supreme Court, when they established that test, basically that's what they said, was that if the establishment's dominant use or dominant purpose was for gambling, then it was a casino. Otherwise, it's not. But it didn't go any further than that to tell us exactly what that means. So the Oregon Lottery has adopted an administrative rule in OAR 177-040-0061, which they call their dominant use, dominant purpose rule. And basically that rule says that lottery will not contract with someone whose dominant use or dominant purpose is the sale of lottery games. And they have defined dominant use as the primary business activity that's going on in that establishment. So if you're a tavern, your primary business activity should be the sale of food and beverages, not the sale of lottery games. And again, dominant purpose they have defined by rule as the reason for being operated. So if you're a tavern, the reason for being operated is not to sell lottery games, it's to sell food and beverages in that tavern and offer a place for people to come socialize. So what lottery uses in order to decide the dominant use or the dominant purpose is two things. First, they look at the ratio of income, the ratio of lottery income versus other income that's coming into that establishment. And the other ratio they look at is how much floor space is being used for lottery purposes versus for the other purposes of the establishment. And for purposes of income, a lottery income cannot exceed 60%. So 40% of the establishment's income must come from other things besides lottery. And the floor space, the floor space for lottery games cannot exceed 15%.
All right. And my follow-up question, naturally, to me, is a dominant is more than 50%. What you are saying, 60% of the sales of this gambling not considered dominant. I think there's a real problem there, as far as I can see it.
Well, if we have in the past looked at that issue as far as what do they mean by dominant, and it's not necessarily preponderance, not, you know, it's above 50%. It's, we have concluded that it's not a 50-50 or 51-49. It's somewhere above that. And lottery has, based on our previous advice, determined that for purposes of what the Supreme Court was saying, that 60% of lottery income was fits that threshold. And we have agreed that 60%, rather than it being because of the nature of the way that that word can be defined, it's not that that the 60% meets the Supreme Court's test.
Okay, my follow-up questions to the director. Do you know how many facilities, there are about 2,500 facilities in our state that are having the video poker games? What percentage of this establishment have close to 60% of the dominant use?
Mr. Chair, that's something that we would look at as someone approaches. We examine it, I believe, every 6 months. It's a small number. We don't have large numbers of retailers, but that's a separate investigation the retail contract section works on. I don't have a precise number. I could find that out for you. The other point I'd make is that there's other limits. That's an artificial number that has been developed just for our guidance. There's nothing that the Supreme Court has said that you have to look at a percentage of income. Clearly, they said floor space. And what this looks like, how does it appear? And the limit on machines was important. You can't have more than six machines in any of these locations. So I think it was more, does this look like what we would envision in our mind, a casino, or is this a business that has machines as part of its business? And I think that's really the theme the court tried to set forward. They didn't give us any standards, and so we've tried to develop some to help us guide. And let's not give the appearance of a casino, because clearly that's what the court looked at, said that'd be wrong. But there are limits on machines, there are limits on forest ways, and let's keep that in mind.
All right. Next concern I have, as the line game introduced, chances are it's going to go up higher. and the issue will come up again, the dominant news, because the sales of the this line game, including the poker, it will increase. Then my fundamental nagging questions I have is, what is casino? Because it's prohibited by the Constitution, and then we are dancing around in the fine line there. Because of its less than 60%, this is not, and if it's over 60%, this is going to be a gambling. That question has to be answered, and I don't see any clear answer for that. So that's why we invite you to clarify on that issue.
Mr. Chair, I just simply repeat my prior answer. I don't believe there's a percentage that answers that question. I believe it is the overall appearance and how a citizen walking down the street would view this business. And that, to me, is the key concept. And the limit on the number of machines is very important. How it's portrayed, how it's advertised, how it's presented, all of those issues are very important. I think it's artificial for us, even though I know it's our rule that establishes or tried to pick a number. I think that's pretty artificial. It's a more global question. We do project a 10% increase because of line games, and we expect there will be increased sales. But we also expect that we're not going to be portraying casinos to our public.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I went to the county assessor, for example, in my county, if I went into Sue Armiller's office and said, how much of this building is allocated to gambling, can they give me any notion of that? How much of the inventory that is assessed for taxes is cooking equipment? How much is gambling? Can they give me any notion of that? And does that give us an idea?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallin, I don't know the answer to that from an assessor's office perspective. I would doubt that they would keep that information. That is something that the retailer would be required to provide to us, and we certainly make inspections. And when someone becomes a retailer, we're going to look at what is the floor space, and we're going to document that. But it doesn't have a different taxation process, so I doubt that a local assessor would keep track of that. But
thank you very much.
All right, and is it possible to ask you to give us a legal opinions on the definition of casino, whether this line game added to the current video games will constitute casino or not, or do you want me ask to the formal letter to the AG on this issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you that based on the Oregon Supreme Court case, the addition of line games, I don't believe would constitute a casino, because it's another version of a video game, and the Constitution authorizes the lottery to operate any game that, including those that use video terminals. So, and based on the Supreme Court's decision, when they looked at the video poker statute, that was the specific question. If we allow video poker games on video terminals, will that make these retailers, these bars and taverns, casinos? And the Supreme Court said no. That it's not the game that's being offered, it's whether or not the dominant use, dominant purpose of that establishment is for gambling. So I would say that based on the Supreme Court's decision, just the fact that lottery is offering video, another type of video lottery game, will not make these establishments casinos unless their dominant use or dominant purpose becomes for gambling. And it's not lottery's intention that happen.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penn, could you please tell us what investment do these restaurants, bars, and taverns have to make to get into this business? I mean, I'm sure they have to have some bonding requirements. What is that, and how do we hold those monies?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I can give you kind of a real brief overview of it. They have to be in business for at least 6 months. So a new business who has not been operating, we require them to operate for 6 months before they could qualify for video. We're going to do a background investigation of the owners and the employees that have access and would be key individuals in providing the dollars to the Oregon Lottery and performing, in effect, the banking services that they do by paying prizes and providing dollars back according to what the values were on the machines. Typically, they have to do some remodeling because they many times will segregate their area from other locations. Perhaps a good example of that is Sherry's Restaurants. In the last couple of years branched into this area, and they have to have a liquor license. So if they didn't have one in the past, they have to get a liquor license because they can't have lottery without a liquor license. Then they have to separate their restaurant area from the location of these machines, and so that can require some remodeling, as I said. There are electrical costs. These machines degenerate and take a lot of electricity. They are going to have to keep amounts of dollars on location to pay jackpots. Our biggest jackpot is $600 on the video lottery, and so that can be an issue. They have higher insurance costs because they do get robbed from time to time, and the insurance industry has just upped, I think, across the boards. All type of insurance has increased, but certainly for our retailers that has gone up. They will typically use other parts of their business as a way to attract customers, so they may cut their food costs to try to attract people, both for their bar and for their video. I mean, that there's a whole business issue there about how they are spending their resources to attract business. And so those are just some of them off the top of my head and the process they follow.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, why do we require that these businesses have a liquor license? Has nothing to do with the ability to work the machine. Something I'm curious about.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, this was back at the beginning of the lottery, and this is by legislation as well, and the thought being that you didn't want to have this particular product exposed to minors. And so an easy way to do that was simply say that it wouldn't be available except in locations where you had to be 21 to be able to enter. And so that was, in a simplistic manner, the reason that was connected with OLCC licenses, to, by its very nature of product, prohibit it from being available to people under 21.
All right. And thank you very much. And by the way, I understand, Sarah, your point of view on the constitutionality of the defining casino, but we are going to request to the Attorney General, formal request, to give us his legal opinion on this matter. Otherwise, this question will linger continually in the future. I hope we can settle this issue. Okay, thank you very much. With that, I didn't know that. We have some people like to testify, and since time is constrained, and we'll continue to go on, but...
Dawn is open.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate
thank
that.
You very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to call... Who is calling? Dawn?
Dawn is open.
Why don't you go get her while we are doing it?
Paul Ritchie.
Okay. May I call the Paul Ritchie at this time?
Good morning, members of the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development. My name is Paul Ritchie, and I reside at 6614 Southwest Virginia in Southwest Portland. I'm a private citizen. I do belong to two groups of interest in the issue of lottery revenue proceeds. One, Stand for Children, which is concerned about budgets for the schools for the next biennium, and Oregon for Tax Fairness, who are active in the lottery issue. In my testimony, I merely wanted to highlight some personal experience, and that was that I was employed by the Port of Portland for about 13 years in the 1980s. 10 of those 13 years, I was watching container load plans in the Marine Cargo Department. I want to highlight this quickly, that between the first half of the 1980s, most containers were full of consumables, TV sets, audio equipment, electronics from Asia. The second half of that decade, I was startled because a shift occurred and containers were often full of robots, car, specifically auto manufacturing robots. The highlight to me is that economically it means that we're getting capital goods rather than consumer goods from our trade partners. That changes some big and important forces in an economy. I found out subsequently that the robots were being imported for foreign manufacturers in the United States. So when one uses the expression the American automobile industry, the auto industry now includes foreign manufacturers and our domestic brand names. To me, that was significant. And the reason I bring it up is because numerous groups, varieties of groups, are economically plying and presenting themselves to Congresses and legislatures to compete for dollars, no matter what their source. And lottery dollars, Mr. Penn makes good presentation. The statistics, it's a good, lively economic business. At age 64, in deference to those over 50, at age 64, I'm concerned about the cash flow, the revenue that goes to education, because I don't look upon education as providing our businesses with an expense, that is to say employees as an expenditure, but that they contribute to the society as assets. And our K-12 state support, to me, that budget needs to be robust and healthy, and it really needs to be robust and healthy to provide $5,424,000,000 to our state education aid. Believe me, gentlemen and ladies, I had to practice saying that in front of a mirror before I can competently say $5,400,000,000. I don't think anybody should breeze through that kind of a number. So I would appeal. On lottery proceeds, we need to maximize the flow of revenue to schools. We must ask that in order to do this, ask the bar and restaurant owners to share in the priority of that large number, $5,424,000,000. To do otherwise might compromise our shared future. In conclusion, in spirit of compromise, it may be necessary to convert to a lottery retailing model such as Oregon Liquor Control Commission, state ownership of lottery retailing, would send a very clear message to the state population that the state intends to maximize potential state revenue for education purposes. I appreciate this opportunity as a private citizen to testify. I also want to remark, having heard some, your remarks about social cost are admirable. The total picture has to be taken, and I thank you again, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Paul. Any questions? All right, thank you. And is Don on the... Okay. May I ask Don Bonder? Oh, thank you. You are the other. Thank you.
No problem. Make it easy for you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Lim and committee members. My name is Don Bonder, and I am with the Oregon Business Association. The Oregon Business Association has spent a great deal of time looking at the data on commission rate for lottery retailers, as did the Lottery Commission last spring when the current contract was negotiated. Though we felt that the adjustment to the current contract was fair, we really felt that the rates should have gone further down last year. We are pleased that the commission elected to lower the commission at that time. Now, with the addition of line games on the horizon in Oregon, we believe it is imperative that the rate is reduced again. The board of directors of OBA are all successful business people who want business to thrive in Oregon. They also know that there is a direct link between a successful state economy and the quality of the essential services that the state provides to its citizens. This is particularly true with the education system. Without a quality system, from pre-K through higher ed, we will not thrive economically in Oregon. It is that simple. Our organization is very much about balance. We work very hard to be the balanced voice for Oregon business. When looking at the body of information that has been gathered on the issue, it is clear to the business people on our board that the commission rate for lottery retailers has been excessive. The goal of the lottery is to balance the level of profitability to retailers while still carrying out the legal responsibility to maximize profits for public purposes, and our board members do not see a balance between these parameters. It is our strong belief that a commission rate of 20% would provide a much better balance for Oregon, keeping businesses that depend on lottery revenue healthy while caring better for the financial state of our state. This rate would produce approximately $68 million. We wish it was billion. That was some longer problem. $68 million badly needed for Oregon schools in this time of severe budget deficits. While no one at OBA believes that in an ideal world, Oregon school children should depend on lottery revenue for a full school year or reasonable class sizes, that's the world we are in today. We ask you, as legislators, to strongly urge the Lottery Commission to make sure their first line of responsibility is to those school children, rather than protecting an excessive commission structure for retailers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All right.
Thank you
for your presentation. And the next is Jody Weiser, please. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn and Commissioners, or representatives, excuse me. My name is Jody Weiser. I live in Portland. Is this on?
Mm-hmm.
And I come speaking for a group called Tax Fairness Oregon. I have also been, just as a private citizen, going to lottery establishments and going to the hearings for a number of years now. So I've been there when the retailers come to speak. And Representative Lynn, I think we have casinos in the state now. I think Dottie's are casinos. They have they are big rooms, and I've wondered until today, I wondered, why do they rent these massive spaces? And then they have this little corner over here with five and now six machines. And now I understand that they have to justify it somehow, and there's just all these extra square feet. And so if we're going to have casinos, then I think we might as well be honest about it and do it in the most productive way we could. We should be getting all of the profit of a Dottie's rather than a percentage of the profit of a Dottie's. But that's my personal view, and now I'd like to speak for the Tax Fairness Oregon. The Oregon Lottery is a business. It's owned by the citizens of Oregon, and it's operated on our behalf. As with any business, good products, low overhead, and good return on investment must be the goals if you are to keep the business owners happy. Those of us who are making objections to the high current rates here today are speaking as citizens, and we're saying that on behalf of citizens, we'd like you to talk to the commissioners and encourage them to lower the commission rates. We think that by lowering overhead for our business, we will increase the profits for our business, and the money will go where it really needs to be. One study has suggested that rates as low as 5% would still allow profit for these businesses from the operation of the machines. The studies have ranged from 5 to 20% on average. Yet, while we've operated this business for 20 years now, we've reduced the rates from 35 to 28, 29% range. So we haven't made a lot of progress in moving towards what we think the real expenses are. I sat in the bar the other evening. For most of the time, there was one woman at one terminal. Shortly before I left, two more people came in. What was provided, besides a 5 by 8 foot piece of space, basically, that was part of the kind of the hallway to the restroom, was that women was delivered a drink that either hadn't been ordered or they just know she wants one of these drinks when they come in, because I didn't see any order taking place. I just saw the drink delivered, and the two other people who came in were nodded to. That was the extent of the interaction. There was, you know, there were pool games, there was food service, there was other stuff going on. That's all it was taking. That's not really worth an average of $68,000 a year. That the costs just don't compute for me at all. The Lottery Commission has, each time they've had hearings and talked about rates, heard threats of mass exodus. They were told at the hearing last week that Sherry said, we won't have line games if you're going to reduce our rates. And yet at the previous hearings, they were saying, if you just give us line games, we'll take lower rates. So there's a lot of distance there between those two sets of words. These false threats were, oh, they did a study too, the Restaurant Owners Association. And the study said that 15% of bars and taverns would drop out of video poker if video poker were to cut their take. In fact, 99.5% of the establishments re-signed contracts, even though there was a cut. There was an increase for them. They could go from having 5 machines to 6 machines. It's unlikely that the closing of some revenue, of some venues, and I think that there might be some venues that have become lottery income dependent, and they won't make it without it. That's likely to happen, but supporting those failing businesses isn't our responsibility as taxpayers. And I don't think the gamblers will go away. I'm told by gamblers and by people who work there that the repeat gamblers will often go from one establishment to another in a single evening or a single afternoon. So they're going to get in their car and drive the 2 extra miles if the closest bar or Dottie's type establishment disappears. Another argument that the commissioners hear is that people have made business decisions and purchased taverns recently based on the anticipation of this income. And as with any other business, it is not our responsibility as taxpayers to look out for people who make ill-advised business decisions. If they had gone online and looked up Oregon Lottery Commissions, they would have found out that this has been up in the air for a long time. And if they'd read the contract, they would know there was a two-week cancellation option in the contract. So if they're buying that business and they are predicating their price on a lot of income from the lottery, that's bad business sense on their part. Arguments are put forward that they're having to drop their health insurance because of the lottery commission rates being lowered. In fact, if you read the article in the Statesman Journal this week about one person who offered to put his tax reports out for everybody to see, he didn't have insurance when he had 35% commission rates. He doesn't have it now. But now that we're thinking of lowering the rates, he's looking into getting health insurance for his employees. It's a false argument. Arguments are put forward that they have just had a rate reduction 6 months ago. But then, as I said before, they said, give us line games and we'll take a rate reduction. Obviously, if they're getting 10 to 17% more revenue coming in, they're going to get way more income unless we reduce rates. And they are doing nothing. They're providing nothing new if we add line games. They're the same amount of electricity. They're the same floor space. They're going to get more customers coming in if it's popular, like they say. So if they're providing nothing new, and they're getting more customers for their other services, why should they get a penny of the increase? It makes no sense. And finally, I want to say that when I was a business owner, if I found out that I was paying seven times more than people were projecting I needed to pay for a product or service I was receiving, I wouldn't go for a contract that was at 5.8% above the lowest figure. I would start at the lowest figure, and then if that didn't get me what I wanted, I would move up. And I think, therefore, that as you speak to to the commissioners, you should suggest that they start at 10%. If we start losing money, if Oregon starts losing money, then we should look at adjusting it up. It's much easier. Nobody is going to complain, you broke my contract and went from 10% to 12%. Nobody will do that. And it would be very easy, case in point study, you know, getting really viable evidence rather than kind of guessing at what the mix is going to be. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you for your advice. All right. Next and last but not least, Bob Glenny, how do I pronounce
Glancy.
That? Glancy, okay. Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Barbara Glancy, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm a working member of MOVE ON, the Metropolitan Alliance for the Common Good.
Could you speak closer to the mic, please? Thank you.
The First Unitarian Church's Economic Justice Action Group, and a group devoted to tax fairness in Oregon. I came today because it's a new year for the legislature, and I hope that with the help of active citizens, it will be a shorter and more productive year than last year. I knew that there was a lottery meeting this afternoon, which I cannot attend, and I did not realize that this meeting was going to focus primarily on the lottery. So my brief remarks, which I composed late at night, the written remarks don't have anything to say about the lottery. I think it's a shame that any state has to depend upon a lottery to get enough money to run their schools properly and the other services with 1% thrown in as a fillip to take care of problem gambling as a result of that. Anyhow, but I will say something about the lottery that I didn't write down. In several of my groups, I have heard people saying that they feel that the rates, that the percentage that the places that are now handling the lottery throughout the state, that percentage should be reduced to something like around 20%. I realize this is a cash cow in a year or a series of years when our legislature has been really strapped. So even lowering that percentage is going to bring in, as people said, $58 million more, and we greatly need that money. I know the citizens of the state are against raising taxes. I had an irate neighbor who ranted against taxes, the legislatures and school boards. She, like many citizens, thinks Oregon has the worst business taxes in the Northwest, which is a myth. Businesses want to be, this is exactly what the woman from the Oregon Business Association said, businesses want to be where it's a good place to live, not one with schools that close early. I know Oregon voted in the kicker because citizens think government is wasteful. They think that until the services they want are cut, and then they change their minds. help the citizens dispel these myths about taxes, create a rainy day fund, and strengthen school systems to attract business. How can we go about this? We examine our tax credits for inconsistencies and ineffectiveness. Buying a hybrid car gets a nice Oregon tax credit. I know because I did it, and that was one of the incentives besides the environmental one that led me to do that. But then the registration fee on hybrids went up. This is just totally inconsistent. The deduction of interest on home loans helps many people own a home who wouldn't be able to do so otherwise. But do we need to provide this service, this credit, for vacation homes? This is ineffective in terms of the purpose of the deduction. Another reason, idea, is to publicize school system audit results to dispel the myths of money, major money, going to administrators. Build support for schools in the minds of your citizens, since you can't provide adequate budget support. Another idea, see the tax delinquents and cheats pay up. Other states like California are using an amnesty or increased penalties program to raise revenue, and it's working. Previous cuts in tax enforcement nationwide in budgets have resulted in lower revenue. That's a cause and effect situation. People will feel better about paying their taxes if they know that everyone is paying their fair share. The legislature can't do all these things alone. We need the support of citizens with common viewpoints to pass laws. The legislature is moving in the right direction by holding hearings and town halls throughout the state. I knew about Oregon when I grew up on the East Coast a long time ago, not just about Lewis and Clark, but about Wayne Morse and Bob Packwood. Maybe this session, some of you legislators will become giants in the minds of Americans. Paul Bunyan would never have become an American myth if there hadn't been a lot of real-life loggers. Let some of your citizens help support the ideas that will make Oregon shine again as a state of opportunity rather than the land of unemployment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, the committee meetings stand adjourned until next Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.